Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Solieri Report, Franklin Sanders, who it's time for our precious metals market report, and there's a tremendous amount to discuss. We're going to talk about both an update on the market and how gold and silver are doing, and then we want to discuss the Fed taper, which is going to have a pretty dramatic impact across the board on all markets, but particularly intriguing is the role that it will play in the gold and silver market. So, Franklin, welcome to the Solieri Report. How's your summer going?
Cool.
This morning was unbelievable.
I know. I woke up this morning and I thought it was going to freeze to death.
Well, I don't know if you realize this, but CNN just put out a report saying that this winter is going to be much colder than last winter. So I don't know how they know that, but...
So comforting that we've got global warming to chill us to death.
Well, tell us, I'm dying to hear what you've been seeing in the markets, because, of course, you're in the gold and silver market every day. So it's been a very interesting time. So bring us up from the last time we talked.
Well, so far, what I had been expecting was that sometime about the middle of this month, or by the middle of this month, which is where we almost are, we would see the unequivocal continuation of what is arguably a rally in silver and gold. And so we've basically seen that, except right now there's just kind of the little problem that silver is lagging gold rather badly. If you look at the gold chart, and I believe I sent you a longer-term gold chart, a weekly chart, what you can see is that there's a downtrend that began in October of 2012, and gold is trying to close above that downtrend, and it's been trending up since the end of last year, and just yesterday closed over that line, but it's been fighting that downtrend line, but hasn't been able to close through it. So what we need to see really is a gold close above 1350 and then a pretty steady advance. But I think you're going to see that from roughly from now until certainly into September, October, and maybe way longer than that. But, you know, we're still looking at the same levels. We need a close over 1350 and then a close over 1390. And then the big barrier is going to come about 1550, where gold broke off back in April of 2013. Once we get over that, then, you know, we can say that a re-rise or another rally has commenced. And just to give you the really long-term view, every primary uptrend or bull market has some kind of big break at midlife. Think of it as a midlife crisis. And so if you look at stocks, they began a primary uptrend in 1982 that lasted until 2000. But in 1987, they had a terrible break, nearly 50%. And it took them about 2.5 years to overcome that break. With silver and gold in beginning of 75 until the middle of, or August actually of 1976, there was a big break in gold and silver, and then it began to recover. But what you have to understand about these two parts of a primary uptrend or bull market is that whatever the percentage gain was in the first part before that midlife crisis, the second part will exceed. So if it gained 700% from the beginning of the bull market to the beginning to the break, from the bottom of the break to the end of the bull market, it will gain more than 700%. So for that reason, we're really looking forward to what silver and gold are going to do. Because it should be better than what we saw from 2000 1991 till 2011. If you look at a shorter-term gold chart, you can see that it's formed a kind of a head and shoulders bottom, and all the momentum indicators like the rate of change and MACD are positive, the RSI is positive. It just really looks like it's got everything going for it except silver. And so we turn to a long-term silver chart and we see that looks pretty good too, because since the October 2012 high, if you take a downtrend line from that, you see that silver has broken out above that downtrend line, and it's made three bottoms there from June of 2013 and in December of 2013, and again this year in May, below $19. And so it started up, it's gotten through that line, but right here lately it's been lagging. And once it really is not far from the downtrend line from the April 2011 high. Once that downtrend line right now comes in about $22.50. So once it gets over that, it'll be doing well. But here recently, if I look at a short-term chart, say about a year and a half, it's very evident that silver can't get through $20. That's what's been slapping it around. And it needs to get through first that $20 level and then $20.50 to turn up. Once silver and gold get into step again, then we're going to see a strong advance. And that should start this month. If you've lived with gold and silver for more than 30 years the way I have, you expect August to be a good month, because normally you get a bottom in June or July or maybe the first early part of August, and then out of August you get a rally that begins and usually carries quite a ways. So there's nothing to contradict my forecast that we're going to pick up here, that gold and silver will pick up and begin in earnest a new rally this month. Would you like to look at some other charts too?
I just want to note, I've got a list on my desk of people who want to be notified when I think it's turned and it's time to buy. But some of them want to buy at 15, I'm saying 15:30 instead of 15:50. But some of them want to buy after it's, the primary trend has been proved to reassert. And some just want to buy, when I think it's a bottom. I'm not 100% clear how I'm going to define that. But have to tell you, Franklin, I'm looking at the politics now. I'm not looking just at the charts. And the politics say to me they could still try and, we could still have to test 1100 again before it heads back up. So I haven't said go yet. And I hope you're right.
Well, can I give you a little rule of thumb on that?
Sure, sure.
If I look right now at the gold chart today, I see that there's, let's call it $1,310 is the place where the downtrend line is. And there's a kind of a rule of thumb that says in order for a breakout to be confirmed, it needs to be at least 3% above the breakout point. So if I take $1,310 as the breakout point and multiply that by 1.03, which is the same thing as adding 3%, I come to $1,349.30. Let's call that $1,350. It is an interesting coincidence that the high that we saw this year in July was $1,346.80.
Right.
So if we get a close above 1350, that's a pretty solid confirmation that the market has turned. That gives you a breakout over that downtrend line for gold from the downtrend line that extends back to October of 2012. And I would be right comfortable with that breakout. The problem always with waiting for confirmations is, which one are you going to wait for?
Right.
When you get a $1,530 price, Yes, sir. That's going to really solidly confirm.
Well, conservative is you wait for a higher high and a higher low. So, one or two of both. So,
right, but those
that's
are,
conservative.
Those are massively higher highs and lower and higher lows. We've gotten the higher highs since December. We have not gotten the we've gotten the higher lows. And we did get some higher highs, but they've been declining, and that's not good. That makes a triangle formation.
Right.
And it's an even-sided triangle, which blows hot and cold out of both sides of its mouth. You don't know what way it's going
to
resolve itself. Right. But for right now, I'd say that the first confirmation is that close above $1,350. And then, without much slacking, gold needs to get through $1,400. To confirm that breakout. The problem, of course, with waiting for 1530, which is not a strategy I can condemn, the problem is that it's $200 higher than where we are now. So,
right, but if you look at what the long term is, that's not going to turn out to be a lot. Right.
No.
So the one thing I do want to make sure everybody understands, if we do retest 1100, that in no way detracts from the chances we're going to reassert the primary trend. We could retest 1100, and it could just be part of the kind of consolidation you and I have been talking about here.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
I think 1100 kind of pushes my boundary a little bit. But if you look at a long-term chart, especially a monthly chart, you'll see that line comes in way down there somewhere. That the uptrend line you would hit is down there considerably. Well, let's look at the U.S. dollar chart, too, because the U.S. dollar chart is very, is very much instrumental in what the gold and silver will do. And oddly enough, it appears the chart – I had to take off stuff, and I'm ashamed of this chart still because it has so much, so many trend lines and so forth on it. It still looks like it's all junked up. But what I'm trying to show is that for basically since last October or last September, the U.S. dollar index has traded in a sideways fashion between 81.50 on the high side and 79 on the bottom side, but within that range, it has made a head and shoulders upside down head and shoulders formation, and it broke out of that last month, and it got up to that 81.50 line, but it can't seem to make up its mind. It will continue to go, it will continue to move up. I mean, it normally when a market gets through a strong resistance like that, it will continue to advance. Now, it may take just a breather to consolidate, but if that head and shoulders formation is accurate, then you're going to get a high in the dollar index somewhere around 82.75 or 83 before it drops. I don't think – I know people believe that the dollar is the primary determinant – the dollar's exchange rate is the primary determinant of the gold price. I'm not that much convinced of that. They can rise together. Right now, the most confusing thing for me is how much geopolitical tension is contributing to the gold price. I'm not sure it's that much. I'm really not. I mean, it ought to be, because if you look at Obama trying to pick a war in Iraq, trying to get involved in a war in Iraq, and trying to get involved in a war in Ukraine, certainly there's reason to be fearful of what kind of war will break out next.
You know, Franklin, in my experience, since I've been a gold investor, my experience is, when the U.S. makes war, dollar up, gold down. So, it's kind of the opposite of what you would expect, because there's an old notion that war, the more chaotic things are, the more people want gold. But that's not been my experience.
Well, I'm not impressed ever when you get some kind of international crisis and gold bumps up $10 or $12. And the reason is because it loses that same impetus just as quickly as the crisis settles down. And so it's like a meaningless rise. It doesn't do anything permanently. But right now, but basically what I'm saying is that the dollar and gold don't always drop together. Sometimes that dollar can be rising and gold can be rising too. It just depends on a lot of different conditions. Part of it depends on the interest rate. And when the Fed is suppressing the interest rate to zero, then there's much more incentive to hold gold because it means that you're not losing interest by holding gold. You're basically holding cash. So back to the charts, I've got a weekly chart of the Dow, and you can see it's formed like a five-year rising wedge, which normally resolves by breaking out to the downside. It broke that downside early this month. It broke that uptrend line, and that's a very, very portentous. The S&P has not done that.
But the S&P chart looks very strong still.
Well, it hasn't broken through that uptrend line. That's correct. Right. So I think, it's not clear what it's doing. I don't think this is the final break. I think that probably will come later in the year. But after a five-year run, you're going to get some kind of long correction. We talked about gold stocks. All the gold stock indices have been stronger than gold during this year. And in fact, if you look at the gold stock indices and you compare them to all the other stock indices and to gold and silver, they have outperformed by a factor of two or three every other category of investment, which is astonishing. But it's also a very good sign because the stocks typically will lead a rally in gold. In other words, they start rising in anticipation of a rally in gold.
Well, they've fallen much more than gold and silver. So the miners they had fallen much more than gold and silver. So they have a lot more to come up. Yeah.
Right. They have more to make up. But if you look at a chart of the XAU, for instance, which is just one gold index, it clearly, since in this year, has done very well. So that's the way it looks right now. In other words, we've come through a 3.5 year correction in gold and silver, and it appears that we have double bottoms in both gold and silver in June and December of last year. There's nothing to contradict that picture yet. And although there is, of course, the potential that we might see a big drop, as you alluded to, one last drop. For the time being, that's not happening. Everything I look at says that that both gold and silver will rally out of August and put an end to that long correction.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, because this is something that kind of bedevils me day to day, is the U.S. stock market is very seriously overdue for 10 or 20% correction.
Yep.
And if that happens, one of the things I've been doing is looking at commodities saying, oh, that looks really good. The problem is if you get the U.S. market correcting 10 or 20%, there's a risk that there's a downdraft on almost everything else. So, that's the only thing that. Yeah, on commodities, I'm particularly interested because, for the last 2.5 years, there's been enormous divergence between the U.S. equity markets and the emerging markets equity markets. And part of that's, they're very commodities related. Mm-hmm. So, the question is.
There are people recommending a rotation out of U.S. stocks and into foreign indices.
Right. And it's, in one hand, it's a no-brainer. The only problem is if you come into the taper and the U.S. market corrects 20%, historical patterns are everything else corrects too. So that's the big question mark. When, right. It's a question of not if, it's a question of when. And the timing on that, 20% is a big number. So the timing on that is sensitive.
Well, let's go back. There has not been a significant a correction of even 10% in what, 2 years?
We had a 5 to 8% in the beginning of this year. So I was kind of checking the box in the 5 to 10% category, and it's, you know, we're way overdue for 10 or 20%. And that's, you know, that's even if you assume a long-term upward trend, let's say we're still in the long-term upward trend, you still need a 10 or 20% to consolidate within that trend, and then more than 20%, then you're, you know, then it's over. So I just can't imagine, you know, and I've been saying that for a long time, I just can't imagine we're not about to get a 10 or 20% correction. So
the possibility of that is increased by the end of the taper, because I don't think anybody questions that the stock market rise has been driven by the taper.
Right, but there are three things. If you want to make a case for a crash up scenario, there are three things that could be playing into this, because every time you look, the biggest conundrum in the securities market is, where do I go on the taper? Because in 2008, we could all just go into fixed income. We can't go there now. In other words, you've got real quality issues and liquidity issues that you didn't have in 2008. And so you have a whole lot more money in the fixed income markets, and it's looking for a place to go because it can't go to fixed income. So that's a problem. And I think it's one of the reasons the dollar and the treasury is doing as well as it is. But the other big swing is we've watched an unprecedented move on governmentally controlled institutions globally of money into equities. And so there's a flow of funds that's happening from the development of the emerging markets, which is a big question mark. And then there's so much more now in the fixed income markets, and it's so much bigger than all the other markets. If people have to get out, you know, if there are credit issues and quality issues, including on sovereign debt, then where are they going to go?
Well, you raised two or three questions. I misspoke myself earlier. I said that the stock market rise has been driven by the taper, and I did not mean that. Of course, I meant it's been driven
by easing.
Quantitative easing. You've also raised the issue that governmental institutions, which is not only sovereign wealth funds but also central banks, have been investing in equities around the globe, so that now they hold, you remember the figure, 40% of all equities. Well, you have now a situation of outright fascism, where official institutions own something like half of the market, and that's a crazy feedback situation. There's an additional problem in the bond market, in that central banks have bought up so much government debt that there's actually a shortage.
Right.
This sounds crazy for
me. Can you imagine this?
Please forgive me. I haven't lost my mind. There is actually a supply shortfall in those markets. And the dangerous thing is that a lot of dealers in those markets are backing out of their inventory or backing down their inventory. That is, they're lowering their inventory levels. And so what that means is that there's less slack for that market to adjust if suddenly people want to start selling those bonds. I think it's just as likely that in the very short term that you'll see a run-up in those stocks because if you look at the 10-year treasury yield, what you see is that it broke out to new highs. It made a breakout in June last year, traded in a sort of sideways but a little bit upward channel, and it's broken down out of that channel this year. The only thing is it hasn't followed through with that breakdown. So if it follows through with that breakdown, then there will be basically a melt up in the price of treasury securities or U.S. bonds, and that would mark an end of the trend. You know, that would be the last blow off of the trend. But see, all of these things are very scary, because what this meddling by the central banks has done is destabilize every market. So when the investor looks, he says, well, where can I get a return? Whoops, no place I can get a return because they've driven interest rates down so low. That means I've got to take on more risk. And, you know, they've brought about supply issues in markets. It's just a wreck. It's a train wreck, and it's very, very difficult, even for people who are a lot smarter than I am, to figure out how to prosper safely in this environment. So
it's funny, Ann Williamson, I don't know if you remember Ann Williamson, she was the reporter who did such a great job of documenting the rape of Russia in the 90s, and she wrote a couple great pieces for WorldNet Daily on the IMF, the World Bank, and the Fed, how they all worked. And I was on the phone with her yesterday, and we were talking about the NSA system, which both of us believe is essentially an insider trading and market manipulation, including consumer markets, not just financial markets.
Yes.
You know, operation. And she said basically what they're trying to do is come up with a way to do communism and a central controlled economy, but make it look like a market system, you know, and digital technology is the key. And, you know, and that's part of what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a very kind of managed and manipulated system, and it can be very frustrating. And I think, you know, it's funny, I think they find it frustrating.
Well, let me go back to what you just said. I think that her comment is the most insightful and the most accurate that I could imagine.
This, right.
The governments have surreptitiously taken over markets. And they, you know, take the stock market, for example. There's no question that they have a plunge protection team, and that plunge protection team invades the stock market at certain levels to keep the stock market from melting down or from crashing. Well, they have, right, in effect, put a floor under the stock market.
And except for this, Franklin, they haven't in this sense. If you are, and this applies not just to the equity markets, but precious metals or any real asset or entity that has real assets or operates real assets, if you have an economy that is this centrally managed and is this leveraged, if it doesn't reground to fundamentals on a regular basis, that's what a market does. It regrounds you back to fundamentals. It regrounds you back to economic supply and demand. You know, it kind of cleanses you regularly, moment to moment, day to day, week to week. If you don't have that regrounding, then the problem is if you look at the markets, you have to be prepared as someone who does what you or I do for the market to swing from a PE of 6 to a PE of 160. Because when something's that centrally controlled and leveraged with both debt and government debt and derivatives, the swing is potentially wild because you haven't regrounded to fundamentals for years.
Well, you just stole my Oh,
sorry.
Thanks a lot, Catherine.
Sorry there.
Well, I mean, what's the purpose of a market? A market is like kidneys, you know, in a market.
Right.
Except in the economy, it's supposed to clean all the bad stuff out of the blood and,
right,
pass the good stuff through. And as you say, there's no way to cleanse the market. There's no way that you can get unprofitable operators out of the market because the government's in the market manipulating it so that the price signal is distorted or suppressed or advanced when it shouldn't be. So this is the inherent problem with central planning, is that central planners ain't God. I mean, that's the simple problem is we don't know what the future holds, and we certainly can't. It's certainly difficult to fade an economy that reflects the desires of 5 billion people.
Well, it's very interesting because Yellen, when she first was appointed, went up and testified, and, you know, she didn't do it in a cranky, whiny way, but basically in a cranky, whiny way, what she said is, you're requiring me to print more money because you refuse to make hard decisions and re-engineer the federal budget. And so you want to delay facing any of these fiscal things that have to be faced. Mm-hmm. And instead, you're requiring me to print money so that we can just delay it some more. And the reality is I can't do this forever, and you need to start making responsible decisions. There needs to be some kind of financial accountability here. And it was really funny because
this is the same thing as a prostitute complaining to her pimp that he makes her practice prostitution.
Right.
You see what I mean? I mean, this is because
But it's so bad that they're now openly complaining to each other in testimony. I mean, that is remarkable. Can you imagine Alan Greenspan complaining about that? And it was, I don't know if you saw it, but Barry Ritzold had an editorial in Bloomberg blaming, you know, Greenspan for the bubble. I was like, well, that was 20 years late.
None of them said that when he was engineering the bubble, did they? They all talked about what a genius he was. But the thing is that central planners always back themselves into a corner, some way or the other. They make some large mistake and keep making that large mistake, like the Fed intervening in 2008 with the mantra, oh, the whole system will fail if we don't intervene. What they mean is that their friends would fail if they didn't intervene, and now we're still paying the price of keeping alive business organizations that should have been allowed to, that should have gone bankrupt.
So let me defend them for a second.
Yeah.
I think in 2008, if the black budget fraud that was involved in the mortgage back and other securities markets had become obvious, mm-hmm. and you hadn't bailed out. I mean, basically what you'd done is you'd sold fraudulent securities intentionally by the U.S. government or with U.S. government credit to our allies around the world. And if we hung them with it and we didn't bail them out, then the black budget fraud would have come out and you would have had a war between the overt side of the government and the covert side of the government. And I think if one of the reasons they did what they did was to avoid that war. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but I think, you know, the financial system could not have tolerated the truth without an incredible violence.
Yeah, I know, but one of these days that's going to have to be faced. I mean, here
absolutely.
Here are the two choices.
I was trying to do it in 94.
Yeah, well, exactly. But here are the two choices, that it will, you don't touch it, it will get worse and worse until it crashes. Literally, the whole financial system comes to a halt and there's no way to put it back together. Or you continue to do it and make it worse and worse. You can continue to do it, make it worse and worse. But on the other hand, what you can do is say, okay, we can't do this anymore. It's ruining us. It's costing lives, not just prosperity, but it's costing lives, and we can't live this way anymore. Now, what are the chances, I think, that Obama and the rest of those clowns will wake up this morning and tomorrow morning and slap themselves on the forehead and say, we can't live this way anymore? I doubt it, because they have their jobs, because they keep their job is to keep the system up.
Right.
But sooner or later, it's going to catch up. And they can paper it over by printing trillions of dollars of money, doing what they've done, quadrupling the money supply in 3 years, that kind of stuff. But at some point.
Well, but I think the insiders think they can pay for it with outsiders' lives. In other words, that they can pay for it with lives, and they can engineer that. That's all part of the slow burn that's happening now. You know, if you look at life expectancies of the most, you know, of the lower income groups, they've been dropping dramatically. So, you know, I think, I hate to say this, but, you know, I think when they couldn't balance the budget in 95, they decided they'd just change the actuarial assumptions and lower life expectancies.
Well, that's been going on for a long time, and if we get into that conversation, then your listeners are going to talk about what terrible conspiratorialists we are.
But I'm not. I'm a portfolio strategist. I understand. I mean, I used to work with these guys. I know how they operate. So I'm not being conspiratorial, but, you know, it's here's the thing. If you can't achieve a fiscal solution, then if you're going to keep the system sustainable, then you've got to change something else. It's a fait accompli. And
well,
that's
it's a mathematical formula, and
right.
you save money if you don't have to keep as many people alive. I mean, I got that picture. And that,
well, let me not get gruesome. Let me turn instead to the taper. Can we talk about the taper?
The famous taper.
The famous taper.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to bring up a number because I've been studying, I was reading this wonderful article, I wrote a commentary about the blog, where an investor was writing about all these different studies where it proves that more information makes you more confident, but it doesn't lead to any wiser decisions. So the important thing is to have the 6 most important pieces of data, not 40 or 80 or 100 pieces of data. So I'm always trying to think, okay, what are the 6 most important pieces of data that will explain how this works? And there was a new clever website put up. It's linked on my blog called J.P. Madoff, and it's by 2 attorneys who represent some of the Madoff victims. And it's about how J.P. Morgan was complicit, and they have – there's a link up on the blog where you can link, and there's this spinning wheel like you'd see in a casino, and it's got about 25 different categories. And if you click on every category, you can see all of J.P. Morgan's settlements for all sorts of fraud. And so they're like 25 different settlements. It totals up to $29 billion of settlements for, you know, just constant criminal activity. Anyway, so I did the calculations. I sat down and I counted up all the quantitative easing on 1, 2, and 3, not other things the Fed did and Fed arbitrage or loans to the banks or anything else. So I'm just talking about the buying of bonds through quantitative easing, including commercial multifamily, single-family mortgage-backed securities. So it comes up to about $3 trillion by the time the taper's over. So if you look at that number and you assume, okay, let's assume that the paper that they bought, so the bonds they bought were really worth about 10 to 50 cents on the dollar. So they paid at par for $3 trillion, and basically 90 to 50% of that was pure subsidy. Okay, so let's say $2 trillion was pure subsidy into the bank. You know, if you look at what 1% of that was, it was the amount that J.P. Morgan has just paid out on all the settlements. Now, it gets even better. I've been following the New York governor's race because there's all sorts of politics going on around it. Cuomo is the governor of New York. He's running for a second term. And, of course, he was the secretary of HUD who was so instrumental in engineering the housing bubble and getting a lot of the laws and regulations changed. And so it's always funny when people say, why is nobody doing anything? And then they're voting for the very guy who did it. And so there's Cuomo. And it turns out New York State, are you ready for this, has a $4 billion windfall surplus from these settlements. Well, Cuomo's running around the state handing the money out to re-engineer his election. It's quite amazing. You know, $250 million for the Tappan Zee Bridge, money for this community, money for that community. So think of it. You have the Fed debase globally, hand the money over to the banks for fraudulent paper. They get a huge windfall. And then they start parsing out different settlements to the governmental entities so the politicians can take their kickback, as you will, and run around and buy everybody up going around the rosy. Quite amazing.
Sounds like a great system to me. A snake eating his tail.
Right. And it's quite remarkable because as you watch the press, nobody ever points out, oh, this is a little circle, you know, and around we go. Anyway, so let's step back up and explain what quantitative easing was and what the taper is. You want me to do it or you want to take a whack at it?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the Fed in 2008, as we were coming out of the bailouts, the Fed faced the question of what are we going to do with the banks owning all of these mortgage-backed securities and other securities? I would submit that we're fraudulently constructed. And so they began a bond buying program quantitative easing one, which is about $1.3 trillion, and then quantitative easing two, and finally in 2000, I guess it was 2012 or 13, said, wait, we need something really, really big, and came out with we're going to buy $40 billion a month, and then a couple months later brought it up, I think December 2012, to $85 billion a month, and that's what they were doing until September of 2013, so about a year at $85 billion a crack every month buying in from the banks. They proceeded to say they were going to cut back to $40 billion, and the markets immediately tanked, and they backed off and went to $85 billion. But finally, between the Bernanke Yellen crossover, they've started to taper, and they're down. You know, they intend to get down, I think, in the last month to $25 billion, and then they say they're going to end with October being the last month. I believe it's October's the last month. And, of course, this has been part of keeping interest rates way down, because you're supplying, you know, massive amounts of financial methadone into the market and, you know, massive amounts of liquidity. Now, part of this, I just think they're having a shredding party. So this is part of cleaning up after the financial coup d'etat. And it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of that bum paper came from paper which had been sold to allies, you know, financial institutions and allies around the world. Anyway. So we're coming into a period. We know, Franklin, that Dodd-Frank dramatically cut back the financial incentives to have big fixed income departments on Wall Street and in the financial community. So this is happening at the same time we're seeing dramatic decrease in fixed income capacity within the financial system. You know, those are the market makers. Those are the guys who provide liquidity. At the same time, you and I and everybody sitting around and saying interest rates can't possibly go any lower. So there's no incentive to really buy bonds because you're not getting any yield. And if interest rates go up, the value of the bonds go down. So you also have the market saying, well, it's the end of the long-term bull market in bonds. You know, where do we go? And anyway, so we're coming into this, into October, which, of course, as you remember, is the silly season. I mean, for anybody who's lived and worked in Washington or Wall Street, October is always the month crazy things happen. So it's a little bit like the pig going through the snake. So we have the end of this provision of liquidity, and we see a lot of things going on in the market where you can tell regulators are concerned about liquidity and sort of getting ready for, you know, uh-oh. So let me ask you the question. What do you think is going to happen on the taper? What do you think is going to happen to interest rates? What do you think is going to happen to liquidity in the markets?
Well, you know, the Fed is always behind the times. That is, they are reactionary. They are not proactive, but reactionary. And I think that once they stop pushing money into the system, which of course goes first into assets, into financial assets, which means stocks. Once they stop doing that, they're going to have a problem with the stock market. It's going to start dropping, and that will scare them, and then they'll start pumping in money again. But the interest rate problem that they face is that the danger is that at some point they pump in so much money that fear begins to take over for the future of the dollar, and interest rates begin to rise to compensate for that. In other words, the market takes interest rates out of the Fed's hands.
Right.
And if they do that, that's the keystone of the whole arch of their operations, and they're sunk. I mean, then the Fed faces everything from mere sickness to a complete collapse of the system and hyperinflation. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying that's what they face. So
right.
I think once they've gotten on this monkey, you know, it's a lot like you use the word methadone, which alludes to heroin addiction. The problem with heroin addiction is once you get on that tiger, or once that monkey gets on your back, let me use the other analogy, it's pretty hard to get that monkey off your back. In fact, it's impossible because your system becomes addicted to it. And I think that's the same place they are with the taper. They know that what they've done is foolish and dangerous, But how do you, once you've done that much of it, how do you get back out of it?
How do you get out of it?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. All of this has no historical precedent or experience. So nobody's ever seen what happens when you in 3 years or 4 years, you quadruple the money supply. What happens when you try to get out of it?
Right.
The answer is nobody's quite sure.
Well, I've talked a lot on the Slater Report about the SEC changing the rules on money market accounts, and now we're starting to see brokers change the rules on who can use the money market accounts versus bank sweeps. So they're trying to engineer more and more customers and more money out of the money market accounts and into the bank sweeps. Now, what's interesting is the SEC did not include government money markets, and yet the brokers... Same thing that from what I've seen is there's a push to get folks, you know, who have cash sitting in their brokerage accounts into FDIC systems, not into the money market. So to me,
excuse me. You're interpreting things differently than I did. Let me
really
understand what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
You're saying that the change in the SEC rules about money market funds, which delivers them from the requirement to maintain a dollar's value, you're saying the goal of that was to drive people into FDIC-insured institutions.
No, right? I'm not. I don't know that for a fact. But what I'm seeing so far from the brokers is they are beginning to switch their arrangements so that you have to have a much higher net worth to access the money markets, and otherwise you have to go into the FDIC insured money sweep.
Well, I mean, you're seeing a different thing in it than I saw. I just saw them preparing for the next panic because, you know, that was a problem in 2008.
Right.
And typically what the people who run the system do is they see the things that didn't work in the last crisis, and they set up firewalls against that. It's kind of like the French building the Maginot Line, you know.
Right.
Which is, in other words, they're always facing the last crisis, and something else happens the next time, something new.
Well, you know, one of the reports this week is that there's real tightening up in the repo market, and the dealers are significantly reducing their positions in the repo market. So we're seeing the actions in the money markets. We're now seeing the actions in the repo market. You know, we've seen the layoffs and the downsizing on the fixed income market. And of course, we keep watching Bill Gross run around and act hysterical about, you know, where is market makers going to be when the world's largest bond fund has to make adjustments?
Well,
so
what you're pointing to, though, is are you saying that credit is drying up? Because isn't that what you're implying?
Here's the thing: the credit is drying up only in the sense that the Fed is no longer buying $85 billion. So in that sense, there is a reduction of infusion in credit. I don't see credit drying up. So let me talk about a couple of examples. For a couple years now, there has basically been a boot on top of smaller banks and banks not to lend to Main Street. So Main Street has literally been shut off from many different kinds of credit. And the SEC, who was supposed to promulgate regulations on crowdfunding to help ease that, still hasn't done it. So the boot has been on when the announcement came out that the housing market was really, you know, going slower, except in a couple of, you know, the areas where we're seeing big reinvestment. You know, what immediately happened about a month, 6 weeks ago, is we started to see articles saying the banks and Fannie were loosening up. So they're loosening up credit in the housing area. That we are seeing. And you know, so that's an offset. So I don't see any diminishment of credit. I just see the institutions getting ready to protect themselves when it comes to liquidity. Now, of course, we also see, you know, junk bonds have done miraculously until very recently, and now I think they're down for the year because we've seen the money moving out of junk bonds into much higher quality. So that's happening. But I'll tell you the one thing that really rang my bells, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this, was when the Ebola stuff started, I said, okay, what's this about? And I was hoping, you know, that it was just about getting as much as you could get on the African-American summit, because they clearly, you know, when you turn around to the Africans and say, if you don't give us what we want, we'll shut off all your tourism business and everything else, you know. So I was hoping it was economic warfare, you know, that and would stop with that. But we have kept seeing the drumbeats about Ebola in this country, and the question is why? What's that about? And my concern is what that is about is, you know, that's your plan B if you have liquidity issues and need to do bank holidays or bank closings.
You're talking about killing people. You're talking.
Well, you don't have to. You don't have to have it be real, Franklin. You don't have to have it to be real. It can be a media event.
Right.
You know. So I'm not. Sorry. Go ahead.
Now, what reinforces that is that if you look at Ebola since it was discovered in 74 or 76, it's killed about 3,000 people. Well, you know,
the flu kills 30,000 every year.
I know. I mean, that's not even a number. And because of that, nobody in private industry has tried to create a vaccination for it because it's just not enough money in it, you know. So the whole thing is suspect. I mean, the whole crisis is suspect, and yet, you know, NPR and all the rest of the media keep beating on that drum about Ebola. Well, give me a break. I mean, this is not a problem. It just isn't. But they're trying to make it a problem. So yes, that makes it suspicious to me.
Well, that's the only thing I can think of. And the one thing I will say is, even if they only think there's a 5% chance of a problem on the taper, they got to be prepared for it. So, you know, they tend to be, I think they're more afraid of the crowd than you or I, because we're sitting in the crowd. You know, the crowd's afraid of them. They're afraid of the crowd.
Right.
And they got to have a plan for the worst case. They can't wait until the worst case happens to put together their disaster recovery plan. So, you know, anyway, so we'll see what happens. What else? Let's talk about you and me and everybody who's listening to this phone call. What do we need to do to be prepared to navigate through the taper period? What should we be doing?
You know, I think one of the things that anybody in today's world has to do is always to be somewhat defensive in his stance, because the taper, I mean, you have alluded to it, but the fact that they stopped sending out that money, potentially, or printing that new money, potentially could cause astounding upset in several different markets. So we don't know what's going to happen, and that means you have to remain relatively defensive in your investments.
Right, and if you're planning on having your business renegotiate your letter of credit in October, that's you might want to get that finished now, and take down a whole bunch of money just in case.
but you know, I think there's a phrase in the prayer book in the Daily Family Prayer. It says, "Give us grace always to live in such a state that we may never be afraid to die."
Right. Right.
I think that's a very, very good recommendation for investment and, you know, financial planning, is always consider, what if everything went wrong? You know, what if everything died? Where am I going to be then?
Here's my biggest concern, because, you know, my belief is that the global financial system will never melt down. Instead, we'll have a war, or we'll have tornadoes. You know, there will be some kind of violent thing. And so I guess I really like the idea of having enough provision for 1 to 3 months. You know, if the world goes nuts, if you're in Kentucky and you have that power outage, you know, I just think there could be some unusual things going on in the fall when things get tense, particularly because we know one of the things I didn't bring up is we don't see, in terms of monetary policy, as much coordination as you might think between the ECB, the Japanese, and the and the U.S. So, you know, you have central banks doing a variety of quantitative easings around the world, and there's a lot of tension now both within the G7 and between the G7 and the G20. So I think the chances of a hiccup, you know, I don't know if it's 5% or 10%, you know, but that chance exists, and that's what you know, if you're a small business and you don't get bailed out, that 5 to 10% can kill you. So you want to make sure you're prepared for, you know, a hiccup in liquidity, a hiccup, you know, in events that could affect your ability to run to the store and get food and other things. I just think, you know, it's, again, being very defensive.
If you don't mind, I'll make the offer to your readers. They can send me an email, and I'll send them a copy of my latest money changer that has an interview with a survival expert in it.
That's a great interview, Franklin. Thank you so much. I'll put that up on the blog if it's okay with you.
Yeah, if they just send me an email at franklin@the-moneychanger.com, and in the subject line put July money changer, then I'll send them a copy of it.
Okay. Well, I can't recommend. That's very generous. I can't recommend that enough. His name is?
Oh, he won't tell his name.
Oh, he won't tell. Okay, his I name, didn't remember. That's why I didn't remember his name.
He said, no, you can't use my name.
But I think that one of the things that was so good about it is he's so sensible. And he really focuses on what the practical risks are and how to get prepared. But I thought it was a very, very useful article.
Well, thank you. He's been studying survival issues for about 30 years, and he and I have very, very frequently. He's really formed my thinking on it, but he's very he's two things. He's well-informed, and he's cheap. Make it very easy to follow his solution.
Yeah, he you know, a lot of people who cover that territory, they'll spend all your money doing stuff that's, you know, a very low probability of ever happening. So
exactly.
I thought that was good. Okay, well, Franklin, I can't thank you enough. Before we close, anything else? You know, the one thing I want to say, it doesn't matter what's happening in the market with the prices. If we get into a crazy kind of situation, there's nothing like having coins you can put in your pocket and walk away.
Oh, absolutely. That's right.
So if you don't have your core position, forget what's happening in the market. Forget what the price is. You need to have a core position. You need to get it now. So, and you need to make sure it's someplace where you can easily get your hands on it and you've got control of it and nobody can intercede between you and the control of your stash. So. You know, all the things we're talking about is why you want to have something that's under your control and is not part of the NSA insider trading system. Okay, Franklin, any last words you want to share with us?
No, I'm just going back to what I said earlier. I think if we all just tried to live every day so that we wouldn't be afraid to die that day, we'd be a lot better off.
Okay, well, listen, you have a wonderful month, and we'll talk to you in 2 months, okay?
Okay, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks.